This episode of To The Journey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international programme of the non-profit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hi, I'm Manuente Reme. I played Ichev on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
I think it's safe to say that no one on this crew has been more obsessed with getting home than I have. But when I think about everything we've been through together, maybe it's not the destination that matters. Maybe it's the journey. And if that journey takes a little longer, so we can do something we all believe in, I can't think of any place I'd rather be, or any people I'd rather be with.
To the journey.
You're here.
To the journey.
Hello, everybody at home, and welcome. This is To The Journey. I'm your co-host, Zachary Frueling, and with me, as always, is...
Kay Shaw.
Well, you might notice that there are only two of us today. That is because Suzanne, at this very moment, we believe, is giving birth to her offspring. Not in the Deanna Troi sense.
She is. Yes, we're eagerly awaiting news.
It might actually happen while we're recording, in which case we will break. We will put the brakes on, we will stop production, and we will make an announcement if we find out. You're smack in the middle of the podcast recording. And someday, I love the idea that someday maybe Suzanne's child will listen to this episode and will be like, you were born right in the middle of this episode of To The Journey.
That would be great.
It would be even cooler if we were like live streaming her into the show while she's giving birth, but that's a little creepy and weird, and it would be very 21st century.
That is a bit creepy and weird. And then something really dramatic would be bound to happen, like in Deadlock, where you think everything's all going smoothly and wonderfully, and then suddenly you've duplicated the ship and all kinds of weird stuff's going down.
So if a Deadlock situation happens, we're not actually sure if we're going to get the real Suzanne back or a duplicate Suzanne, or whether she's going to have the duplicate child or the real child. We have no idea how this is going to unfold, so keep your fingers crossed. But in the meantime, we are going to do an episode of To The Journey, and we are going to be doing a comparison between the Hirogen and the Deep Space Nine episode Captive Pursuit, also known as the Tosk episode. That's how I remember it. I don't know how you remember it, Kay.
That is how I also remember it.
Tosk. I am Tosk.
Tosk.
I'm Tosk. How about you? You feeling Tosk today?
I'm pretty Tosk, yeah. It's got to Friday.
I think we just coined a phrase.
Yeah. Well, I've cracked out the cider, so that tells you how Tosk I'm feeling.
Not tossed, Tosk.
Oh, okay.
So this was your idea to talk about this topic, Kay. You came up with this idea to compare the Hirogen with this episode from Deep Space Nine, Captive Pursuit, which I think is a brilliant comparison because I've always thought of the hunters inside that episode of Deep Space Nine as like proto-Hirogen, except they've got these dorky space helmets and these cool little space suits. It's very weird. It kind of looks like something you'd see in Spaceballs. Like they've got this funky helmet and the funky suits. It's very ironic.
I actually watched Deep Space Nine after I watched Voyager. I watched the majority of Deep Space Nine after I watched Voyager. So when this episode came up, I think it reminded me of the Hirogen straight away. When we decided we were going to do this, I actually went and sort of dug around to see if there was any sort of writing influences that were shared between the two. And I couldn't find that the same people had been involved in the two of them. So whether an influence was picked up there or not, I don't really know. But I think the parallels are pretty obvious. It's an episode that sticks in my head. I don't really know why, because it's not a brilliant episode particularly. It's a fairly run-of-the-mill Star Trek episode, but it's one that sticks in my head.
Well, it's a fairly, I don't want to say run-of-the-mill, but a very Star Trek-y kind of moral dilemma going on inside that episode, right? On the one hand, you've got the prime directive and non-interference and overall tolerance and respect for how other cultures function, contrasting that with the innate rights of the individual being hunted and the kind of moral repugnance from our standpoint of that activity of hunting another sentient being. So it's a very Star Trek moral dilemma. But for me, what makes that episode charming is it's all about the way Chief O'Brien and T'Sk interact with each other. They're such a charming pair. It's like we're talking about proto things. Like if the hunters are the proto Hirogen, they're like the proto Julian O'Brien bromance.
Yes. Yeah, because it's a very, very early episode of Deep Space Nine. I think it's like episode 5 of season 1. So it's some of the most early stuff we see. And it's quite interesting because I think there are a few things in this episode that instantly just make me sort of think, oh yeah, you can really see that this is like the embryonic versions of some of these characters, that they haven't really sort of found their wings yet. But yeah, I do like it, even though, like I said, I think it's fairly run-of-the-mill because of that reason. I think the relationship between O'Brien and T'Sk is very compelling. It's very charming, I think you said when we were talking about this before we started recording. There's a charm about it.
So I'm trying to put myself back in early 90s mentality. You know, we are used to seeing the Hirogen on Voyager. We've had, you know, a darker version of Star Trek in Enterprise. And so looking, you know, back in the early 90s, these concepts were really new. Had we ever really seen a race being hunted by another race at that point in Star Trek, or was this the first instance of that kind of activity? You know, we're looking at it now after having seen the Hirogen. I think it doesn't phase us. It's not as novel of an idea as it was back in the early 90s.
No. And I think seeing it after the Hirogen, like you said, who, because they feature in quite a number of episodes, 8 or 9 episodes maybe, they actually feature and they're probably mentioned in the same number again. It becomes quite developed in that way. So I find it interesting to think about, well, what would it have been like if I'd seen that beforehand? I don't remember anything in Next Gen of a similar...
Well, the Next Generation was relatively genteel and refined compared to Deep Space Nine. So an episode like this, I think, shows the grittiness of what they were going for with Deep Space Nine in general. And then the Hirogen took it to another level, right? The Hirogen are going to... Well, hold on. And then the Hirogen took it to another level. If these aliens in Deep Space Nine, these hunters and their dorky helmets and their funny colored spacesuits, they might chase you around with their guns and hunt you, but the Hirogens are going to like string you up and hang your innards out to dry.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Take all your internal bits and bobs as trophies and all the rest of it. So, yeah. Any particularly interesting bits, I think? Whatever it is that Hirogen deem interesting in that way. But yeah, they're all about the trophy taking, aren't they?
They are. And so the Hirogen are like souped up versions of this idea that was germinated in Deep Space Nine, I think.
Yeah, and I think whilst there are some obvious similarities, and it's hard to believe that, you know, that's not where the ideas come from, that it's not somebody who's seen that and gone, oh, we could totally develop that. There are some obvious differences as well. And I find those differences really interesting, the way that I think the most obvious difference really is the fact that obviously in the Deep Space Nine episode, this is actually a member of that species who's been bred specifically for that purpose, and obviously with the Hirogen, they go and find their own prey that's within other species.
Well, does that make it any better or worse, or does it make it morally exactly the same? That's my fundamental question, right?
That's what I've been trying to work out as well. So I think we can have an interesting discussion about that.
On the one hand, if a culture should be tolerated, should be respected, if the Federation should have non-interference as their standpoint regarding, you know, what could be perceived as moral repugnancy, you know, but if they take a hands-off policy, does the fact that it's all internal to one culture make it any more acceptable than hunting another culture? Yeah, I think there's no other way to frame this except to kind of juxtapose it in terms of the rights of the individual being hunted. Does the fact that it's internal to a culture negate the individual rights of the person being hunted any more than an external hunting situation that you described?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, you know, the Federation is all about rights of sentient beings too, and they constantly take these two opposing ideas of non-interference and innate rights of the individual, and they clash against each other. These are two, you know, mostly conflicting values every time we see an interesting moral dilemma in Star Trek. And I think an episode like this is where they meet just head on. You know, this is something that from the one standpoint looks totally morally repugnant, but then it would be overstepping the Federation's bounds to intervene in any way.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think on the face of it, I think it would be easy to assume that actually the way that this race in Deep Space Nine, who we don't actually learn what they're called as a race. We only learn what this TOSC is called, which is obviously the name of this individual or set of individuals that get bred specifically to be hunted. So I think I'll just refer to them as the TOSC in order to avoid confusion. But it seems on the face of it that that's actually better, in inverted commas, because he seems like he's all on board with it. But I think actually, in reality, because he's been bred for that, and that's all he's ever known, and that's like what he's been brought up in and what he's been told, has he ever really had a choice in that? That's the question I've got.
But that's like a slave who loves his chains, right? He doesn't know any different. That doesn't make it right just because someone's okay with being a captive and being hunted.
No, it doesn't. Because he's not really had the opportunity to ever see that there could be something different.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the philosopher, so I'm always going to like drop a Plato metaphor, right? This is like being stuck inside Plato's cave, staring at shadows on the wall. If that's all you know, if you just lived your entire life inside of a cave, you don't know that there's another way of living life. And if you're bred to be hunted, and you're bred to be captive, and you're bred to be a slave, and you don't know any different, that's your entire worldview. You don't even see possibilities for your life outside of that. And how sad is that? That's a tragic situation.
It is really sad. I don't really think it's possible to say one's better than the other, or one's more moral or less moral than the other. I think they're different. I think it's a different way of doing things, but I don't think either's better.
But I guess in that situation, fundamentally, unless you just want to hand wave, because you can totally hand wave and say, we don't know how to resolve the dilemma. And oftentimes in Star Trek, that's what they do. They err on the side of non-interference because they don't know how to resolve the dilemma, right? But that's the fundamental question. Which is the most important factor? Do the innate rights of the individual outweigh non-interference? Or is it more important to take the standpoint of non-interference so we don't impose our morality in other cultures? You know, one of those has to end up being that you don't get to play it totally neutral. If you don't interfere, you've made a choice not to interfere. And if you do interfere, like O'Brien does in that episode of Deep Space Nine, he's made a choice that the rights of the individual matter more. So it's almost like you can't help but make a choice to prioritize one of those two factors over the other, no matter what you do.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not just O'Brien, because of course, we get the little scene at the end where we get this slight hint of the fact that obviously, well, first of all, we see Sisko sort of say to Odo, oh, don't rush about going to try and catch him. And then at the end, when Sisko gives O'Brien his dressing down, he very much gets I always thought that we'd get caught quicker because I thought that we'd run into all these force fields, and oddly enough, they weren't there. It's like, and then we get this nice little bit where he turns towards the camera at the end and smiles after O'Brien's walked out. I really like that. So they've made a collective decision in that way. So.
And I think that's what I love about Deep Space Nine. I love the moral ambiguity of all the characters involved in this episode, right? Sisko is morally ambiguous because he's letting O'Brien get away with this scheme. He's pulling to try to get Tosk away. And O'Brien's being morally questionable because he's disobeying orders. And Tosk is having this revelation about his own identity. It's all very shades of gray inside Deep Space Nine. But in Voyager, I feel like with the Hirogen, it's a much more cut and dry. Like the Hirogen hunt people, and that's bad.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm slightly distracted because we have a message from Suzanne.
Do we really have the message from Suzanne?
We do have the message from Suzanne with a photo and everything.
So stop the presses. This just in, as predicted. This is no joke. This is happening in real time. This is not an act. Yep. This is not fake.
We literally just got a message
from Suzanne that she has given birth to a baby. What is it? And what's the name? Kay, give the announcement.
It's a baby Borg. No, it's a baby boy. Sorry.
That happens a lot on Voyager. And more often than you'd think on To the Journey.
It is. It's a little boy. It's a little boy. And his name is Logan.
Logan? Yes. I was hoping for a Star Trek name or maybe a little baby Zachary.
Maybe it's Logan Zachary. Wait, she hasn't told us about middle names.
Do you think it's Logan Chakotay Williamson?
Is his middle name Chakotay? I'm just going to ask now.
Ask her in real time. Is his middle name Chakotay? Chuckles?
I don't know whether she's going to reply because I think she might have just sent the message and gone back to, you know, the fact that she had a baby just...
Well, that's very exciting.
I'm excited!
So since Suzanne has now officially given birth, we knew this was coming, but Suzanne is going to be stepping away from To the Journey for just a little while she tends to her new parenting duties. We're going to keep To the Journey going. We're going to have a couple of guests on in her place, but Suzanne will be back with us in a few weeks. But we are going to keep To the Journey going while Suzanne is taking care of business. Taking care of business.
Yes, absolutely. There you go. That was our best tangent ever. That's our official. That's our official best tangent ever. We can't beat that
well,
now.
I feel like people have a love-hate relationship with our To the Journey tangents. Some people love our tangents. We've got a little hate mail about our tangents. It doesn't matter. It's our show. We're going to do whatever tangents we think are appropriate. And Suzanne having a baby live on To the Journey is definitely a tangent-worthy
it
event.
It is definitely a good tangent. Nobody complain about this one. Okay, so we were talking about interfering or not interfering, I think, weren't we?
We were. I guess the question is, you know, is one of those factors non-interference versus the innate rights of the individual, which one of those has precedence? Every time the Federation decides not to intervene, they're basically, I think, making a choice that non-interference is more important than the rights of the individual. Every time the Federation decides not to interfere, they're essentially making a choice that non-interference outweighs the rights of the individual. And I think that's a hard pill to swallow because the Federation is generally compassionate and they do want to do right by the individuals and the sentient beings they encounter. On the other hand, I think the Federation's perspective is that the danger of interfering is greater than the danger of ignoring the rights of a particular individual. You have the power to shape entire cultures and entire worlds when you start interfering. When you're talking about the rights of the individual, you're still talking about one person. So I think the Federation just sees a greater danger in interfering, so they tend to play it really cautious in these morally ambiguous situations involving other cultures.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the root of the Prime Directive for me is the fact that the Federation wants to avoid becoming the galaxy's policeman, basically. That's what they're trying to avoid. And I think rightly so, although at times it's very hard to watch that and it's very hard for us to understand why they wouldn't interfere. I think we could get into a really long debate about the Prime Directive here and how it's played out through the whole of Star Trek, and I'm going to try and avoid doing that. But I think sometimes it's kind of considered to be more of a guideline, because we do see it broken, I think, more often than we see it get adhered to.
Someone's got to stand up for the rights of the little guy. And I think that, you know, when someone is asking for help, like if there's a morally ambiguous situation going on and the person who's being hunted is crying for help, like, help me, save me from these people who are hunting me, then you have a clear cry for help and you're more justified intervening. And in that Deep Space Nine episode, Captive Pursuit, they are struggling to get Tosk to even ask for help, to get him to recognize that he's in a situation that calls for help.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think my understanding of the Prime Directive is that if the culture in question asks for help, or somebody from within that culture asks for help, then at that point they're allowed to interfere because they've been asked for help.
We need to ask Larry Nemechek, because that's probably clause number 13 out of 47 different separate clauses in the Prime Directive.
Yeah, but that's kind of how I've always understood it. I mean, I think the Prime Directive kind of changes and evolves over time, and I think sometimes it's easy to get confused about what's actually covered under it and what isn't, because I think in the early days of the Prime Directive, the implication is that, oh, it only applies to non-warp cultures and things like that. And I think in terms of you actually going and sort of revealing that you exist, that part of the Prime Directive, yes, I think that part is specifically designed for non-warp cultures. But that doesn't mean that warp-capable cultures are not covered under the Prime Directive when it comes to interfering in their internal politics. And I think this would definitely count as interfering in their internal politics. So it's tough. But it's kind of like we shouldn't really get involved, because what gives us the right to say that our way of doing things is better than their way of doing
things? Yeah, I think there's the letter of the Prime Directive and all of its, you know, specific situations that it calls for. And then there's like the spirit of the Prime Directive, the idea of non-interfering with the natural evolution of a culture. And by extension, I think maybe as a corollary to that, by extension, not making judgments about their morality.
Yeah. Because I think you can fall into the trap with the Prime Directive of assuming that, it, you know, if we think that, oh, well, we should interfere because this is wrong, that we're always right about the way everything that should be. And we think we are right because we understand our morality and we understand how we operate, and we don't really understand how other people operate.
The Federation's not morally neutral. They have their own values, and they prioritize life, and they prioritize sentience, and they prioritize rights of the individual. So it's not that the Federation is morally neutral. It's just that they don't want to impose that on other cultures.
Yeah. And I think that's where it becomes important, because it's easy for us to say, oh, well, that's right and that's wrong. Well, it is under our morality, but other people have a different interpretation of that, and we can't just go storming in everywhere saying, well, we're right.
Yeah, and I think that's what's tough, because when you're talking about rights, like the rights of the individual, you're not just talking about rights for us, for our little culture. You're talking about some sort of universal innate rights for everyone, everywhere, for any sentient being, right? So when you see a sentient being that's part of another culture that from our standpoint looks like it's being abused or being taken advantage of or being hunted in this case, you want to intervene because you think it's morally wrong. And that's what it means the whole notion of an innate right is that it's innate for everyone. It's not just that we have rights and some people don't. Everyone has rights. So, it's hard to check your own compassion, your own sense of universality about things like innate fundamental rights, just because it's happening somewhere else that isn't part of your group, part of your social clique.
Yeah. And I mean, as well, I think the whole thing about letting cultures develop on their own is because I think it's been demonstrated throughout history that people are much more likely to do things a certain way if they've come to that conclusion by themselves rather than somebody else telling them you're supposed to do it this way. That generally generates resistance, not acceptance. You know, generally somebody trying to hit you and tell you, I mean, not necessarily that that's how the Federation would do it, but somebody coming storming in saying you're doing this wrong, this is what you're supposed to be doing. Generally, it's not generally met with a very friendly attitude.
Don't you wince a little bit inside every single time a Starfleet captain, whether it's Captain Picard, who does this a lot, or whether it's Captain Janeway, she does it in Voyager too. Don't you wince a little bit every time they order the ship away from a situation that you feel like they should intervene in? It's like, no, come on, we need to do the right thing more than that. And it's like, it's a tough decision. They see the suffering before their very eyes and they still have to order the ship away from it.
Yeah, it's tough.
So I do want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the Hirogen in particular, because I feel like the situation in Voyager is a little different. In this episode of Deep Space Nine that we've been talking about, Captive Pursuit, I feel like we have a pretty clear moral situation. We have a hunter and a hunted, right? In Voyager, I feel like they were constantly trying to up the game and introduce new alien races that were bigger, badder, scarier than the last alien races they introduced. So they introduce the Hirogen. Then they've got Species 8472, and that's bigger than the Borg. It's like this battle royal of really scary, bad races, and they all try to duke it out with each other, and they're constantly one-upping each other.
Yeah, I think that there is some of that. But I think the Hirogen, for me, I think are probably one of the more interesting out of the races that do get introduced in Voyager. I think they have more interesting stuff going on. And even though, in a way, you could see them as quite one-dimensional because they're all about the hunt, that is actually talked about. The fact that they're all about the hunt is actually addressed, and the fact that this is causing like the breakdown of their society, and the fact that eventually they're going to die out because they're not progressing, because they're not spending any time doing other things. And I like the fact that actually we get that depth. Because, like, it's sort of almost, for me, it reflects a little bit on, like, the various issues that I've had over the years with, like, the Klingons, because they're quite one-dimensional. You think, well, there must be people farming and people researching and people doing other things than being warriors, because how can you have a society that's just warriors? And I kind of like the fact that with the Hirogen, we get that addressed. The fact that they're so focused on the hunt means that their society is essentially falling apart.
Well, and that depth was what was lacking inside that lone standalone episode of Deep Space Nine, right? You wanted to go, wait a minute, how does this culture function? What's the relationship between these two different subspecies, and how does their society function, and what is it like to be part of either one of them? You just had no depth, right? You had the hunt and no real backstory. And the fact that we do get some backstory in the Hirogen and some sense of what's working well and not working well in their culture is interesting. I like that. I like that depth, but they lost me at the Hirogen Nazis, honestly. That's when I was just like, I'm done. I don't get the Hirogen. I can't. Every time they bring up Nazis in Star Trek, I know why they're doing it. And I know it's a theme and it's a tradition. And I see the commentary aspect of it too. But every time it's like Nazis in Star Trek, oh, no. Next episode, please. So I think that I think that actually did a disservice. That kind of thing did a disservice to how scary and how interesting the Hirogen were supposed to be.
Yeah, I do get that, and I think, I do sometimes struggle with Star Trek's seeming obsession with just randomly throwing Nazis in because they seem
it's a tradition, right?
On a regular basis, most, it is a bit of
what
a tradition.
Is it like four out of five of the last Star Trek series have had Nazis in them? You just do it because it's a tradition at a certain point. It's supposed to be tongue in cheek when they do it. I get it. But I just worry that that kind of thing, it's like, okay, if the Hirogen are happy playing Nazis on the holodeck, how seriously can we take them, really, as a bad guy?
Yeah, yeah. And I think, well, okay, so in a way, I think the fact that they, in the Killing Game, we see them play out the Nazis in that way kind of muddies the water for me, because I find the fact that they've then created this holodeck program, brainwashed our crew so they've forgotten who they are and they've taken on these other identities, that I find really fascinating. And I do really enjoy that double episode, despite the fact that, yeah, I do have a little bit of an issue with the Nazi thing. But I think that maybe muddies the fact that actually it's a really interesting concept. And then obviously that takes us forward in terms of the sort of holodeck technology and everything else that then brings us back to further stories later on.
Well, it speaks to a fundamental difference. There's the activity of doing the hunting, and then there's the culture around it. Like, what is the cultural need, and what are the activities around the hunt? And you see it here in the real world. Like, there's hunting. Like, people who hunt for food. Like, they take their gun, and they go out, and they shoot something, and then they eat it, right? That's, you need sustenance. So, you know, it's kind of a basic rule of life on our planet that for something to live, for one thing to live, something else has to die, whether animal or vegetable, right? Yeah. So, okay, sure. There's the activity of hunting, but then there's the culture around it, right? There's the clothes and the gear and the parties and the drinking the beer and the whatever you do when you're hunting, right? There's all this stuff that surrounds, you know, the activity itself. And I think this is interesting because the Hirogen are all about the hunt. On the other hand, we get to see some really interesting, like a weird cultural look into the gamesmanship of the hunt inside that episode. It's like, it's game-like. It's not just about hunting.
Yeah, it is. And you know, I think because we don't see the race in the DS9 episode too much, we don't really know how deeply this goes in terms of their culture. But I think certainly with the Hirogen, we get to see all the ritual that surrounds it, and the fact that it almost kind of takes on a spiritual quality.
I mean, like, do they get a blue ribbon? Do they get a trophy? Do they get adulation? Like, what happens when the hunter gets the hunted, or if the hunted escapes? Like, what's the victory prize? What's the consequence?
Yeah, we don't really see that with kind of the Tosk race, do we? We don't really get to find out exactly what happens afterwards. I mean, we hear about this idea of an honourable death for the Tosk, but in terms of the prowess for the hunters and how that's celebrated afterwards, I don't know. I kind of wonder in my head whether or not there's some kind of, they go back to the home world and there's some kind of party and all that type of thing. But certainly with the Hirogen, we find out that, you know, they take trophies from the prey that they've killed, and that allows them to sort of attract females or whatever.
Whatever they do with their trophies.
I'm not sure how I feel about
that.
Yeah,
what purpose do the trophies serve? Okay, so they attract the females. Do they get some serious street cred? You know, are they worth money in some way? Like, what role do these trophies play for the Hirogen?
From what I recall, they sort of display them around their ships, don't they? They have them sort of hanging from the roof.
Oh, totally. They're everywhere. Like, I have these, like, I haven't watched the episode in a while, but I have these kind of visions of, you know, trophies and body parts and bones kind of hanging all around the ship.
Hanging around. And then, you know, if a lady Hirogen shows up, they're like, ooh, I like the look of your trophy display there.
Oh, your bone necklace is bigger than his bone necklace. So.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, not great in terms of equality there, but, you know, we'll gloss
maybe
over
the
that.
Lady,
for the
maybe
of
the
this
lady
discussion.
Hirogen are some serious badass hunters themselves.
Maybe they are, because we don't really get to hear about that too much.
Like full on and Hunger Games, kind of, you know, maybe they're really good at it.
Because we never actually see one. We do hear about them, but we never actually see one.
Do we hear that they're hunters?
I don't think they are. I think we hear that they're not, actually.
I couldn't recall.
From my memory. I think we hear that they basically just hanging around on their ships waiting for some dude with lots of trophies to show up.
To bring, it's like a cat bringing a mouse home. It's like, here's your trophy, honey.
Yeah, pretty much.
Thanks, big stud.
A really nice clavicle today. I'll polish it for you and we'll put it on the mantelpiece.
Like a dried intestines necklace, like, ugh. Yeah. Yeah. Ugh. The Hirogen have this kind of squishy, gross element to them that I didn't really get from the Deep Space Nine episode. Like, the Hirogen are more like Klingons, right? They like the blood and the gore and the violence and the, you know, the sheer visceralness of that kind of thing. And I didn't really get that sense from the Deep Space Nine episode. Even though there's a hunt going on, it didn't have that raw physicality.
Yeah, it was quite airbrushed in the nature of a lot of Star Trek episodes, yeah.
So were the actors, if memory serves.
It's like, well, we're going to kill him, but we're going to do it in a very kind of clean, sterile way. There's not going to be any innards.
We're going to kill him with our zapper guns with our little space helmets.
Yeah, exactly.
It kind of reminds me of Mars Attacks. That's how I think of the aliens in that Deep Space Nine episode. Don't they kind of...
They do
they
look
got the
quite
helmets
cheesy,
and the cheesy outfits. And yeah, they're like little, you know...
It is a very cheesy outfit, yeah.
It's very cheesy outfit.
The Herojin look pretty intimidating by comparison. You know, when they first show up, it's like, whoa, who are these guys?
Well, they didn't intimidate Seven of Nine when she zapped the one guy over the subspace
network. No, that's true. But then I don't think many people intimidate Seven of Nine. So it's pretty hard to intimidate Seven of Nine.
Yeah, 709 decorates her cargo bay with Herojin trophies.
She's got a whole row of Herojin helmets just hanging up there.
Just on a shelf somewhere.
It's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of 9.
7 of 9.
I just went there. And again, I think also with the Deep Space Nine one, just because of the briefness of it and the fact that we don't actually really find out about this hunt aspect until well into the episode because of this whole oath of silence idea, we don't really get to see much of the ritual that's around the hunting part of it. But with the Herojin, we certainly get to see like the idea that they paint their faces and that type of thing.
Yeah, the face paint connotes some sort of like tribalism that I didn't get out of, right? You know, these are hunters. They paint their faces almost like, you know, like in Braveheart, like the warriors paint their faces and they go out to, you know, slay the British.
Yeah, the English.
The English, excuse me. The yes. English. I could try to do it with a Scottish accent. The English.
Yeah, don't.
No. Yeah. Well, okay, there's something to this, because in that kind of tribal culture, to vastly overgeneralize, there's a spiritual component to it, right? And I think you could plausibly say that hunting is a form of oneness with the natural world around you. Something has to live, something has to die, and that's part of the natural order of things. I get that sense when I go fishing, honestly. I'm not a hunter, but I am a fisher person. Like, when I go fishing, I know I'm going to kill the fish, right? That's an unfortunate truth, but it's true.
Yeah, and you're going to eat it.
And I'm going to eat it, and it's part of the circle of life, and it's a beautiful thing. The fish jumps out of the water. I get to, you know, carry back, and there's a social component to it. It's part of the beauty of us as a species in the natural world, given Absolutely. The natural order of things. It's sad the fish has to die, but there's a wholeness to nature that you can plausibly say I'm a part of that when I'm doing that kind of activity. So, and I think you know, for the Herojin, I could see kind of a spiritual component of that. I have no idea what's going on in the Deep Space Nine episode because we don't get enough backstory. But with Herojin, given the face paint and the tribalism and the trophies and I could say you could plausibly say that that's their view of themselves, their place in the natural order of things is to be at the top of the food chain, proverbially.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm totally with you on that. I get, although I'm not somebody that's gone out and sort of fished or hunted myself, I could totally get the idea of sort of, because you go out and do that, you feel like you're a part of it rather than being separate from it.
Yeah, it's a spiritual thing. Like it's a transcendental kind of experience. Like, you know, I mean, this is like the transcendentalists, like Thoreau and Emerson. I mean, they really thought that being out and involved in nature and, you know, there was a spiritual quasi-metaphysical experience to it, right? You know, a oneness with the order of things.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting what you say about tribalism as well, because I think mostly we see that the Herojin tend to sort of hunt in very small groups, sometimes even only in pairs. But I think when there's very challenging prey, we do see that they kind of group together. And there's that kind of pack mentality that they sort of get together in a pack or a tribe to take down the big animal kind of thing, and that's interesting as well.
So we're kind of romanticizing the Herojin here. Are we doing so justifiably? I mean, the Herojin are pretty bad people inside Voyager. From the Voyager standpoint, they're hunters. They're not as evolved morally, right? So are we over romanticizing them going this direction, or are we making them sympathetic, you know?
Oh, I wouldn't say it was over romanticizing. For me, I think it's more about trying to get inside their heads and understand how they see themselves. That's not how necessarily we see it if we take a step back from
it. I think it's a truism that everyone is a hero of their own story, right? So inside the Herojin's mind, they are the heroes of their own narratives. They're the hunters. They're the top of the food chain. They're the pinnacle. They're the center of creation. Whatever it is, right? It's all about them, and they're the ones who are hunting.
Yeah. I mean, I think What I kind of take from that question, really, is that if we're saying that, oh, well, the Hirogen are actually kind of bad people because they're going around killing other species, and yet we're seeing the romantic side of people on Earth hunting animals and fish and all the rest of it. I think the real question for me that comes out of that is, well, because of the fact that they're hunting things that are sentient rather than things that are not sentient, is that where the line changes? Is that where we morally see it as different? Because this is a sentient thing that you're hunting. Does that make it not okay? Whereas if it's not a sentient being, it is okay.
Well,
is
that I think question? It's clear that from the Federation standpoint, hunting a sentient being is wrong. That doesn't mean they should interfere, right? They still have non-interference to take into account. But I don't think, I wouldn't have any trouble with saying that the vast majority of Starfleet officers and Federation citizens would say that hunting another sentient being is morally wrong.
Yeah, but I'm saying in the 24th century, in terms of hunting non-sentient animals, is that something they still do, or is that something that we've stopped doing at that point?
Oh, Worf does.
Well, yeah, but I mean, we're talking about Klingons there. I'm probably more leaning towards asking the questions of humans. And if we're saying that humans do still hunt animals in the 24th
century... Well, they don't need to anymore. They have replicated food, right? Exactly. Even if we want to eat meat, you don't have to go out and hunt it. You don't even have to do it by proxy and have other people kill your food for you, right? So that's how we do it here in the civilized world. We have other people kill our food for us and then we eat it, right? You don't even have to do that in the 24th century because they have things like replicators. So I think that makes it even harder to understand where the Hirogen are coming from, maybe.
Yeah.
But even if you do understand where they're coming from, I guess this is my point. We can understand how the Hirogen function, how they think of themselves, why they do what they do, and all the social and causal and spiritual factors that go into it. But you can understand all that causal reasoning and still think that it's morally wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I think it is interesting that, although I don't think that the Hirogen hunt exclusively for food, we do see that they actually do eat their prey sometimes. Because they do actually use their prey for food on occasion. And we do hear about the fact that they do that. So does that make it any better?
I would say it makes it more part of the natural order of things, right? I mean, yeah. I feel like this about eating meat. I'm not a vegetarian. I would like to be. In a perfect world, I'd be a vegetarian. I hate having to kill other beings to survive. And I don't have to. I could become a vegetarian, but I sure like my meat, right? So I don't do that. It's terrible. I think of that as a moral failing of myself and maybe of people in general. But I do feel like that it is a basic biological fact that something has to die for another being to live. It's sad that it has to be sentient beings sometimes. And makes it maybe just a hair better, like a smidgen better, because it places it in the biological realm, right, rather than the cultural realm. Right.
Because it's not just for sport, it's to eat. And then that makes it more within what we find acceptable.
Exactly. Maybe. If it's purely a cultural thing, the hunt, the sociology of how the Hirogen function as a society, right, then that is somehow worse to me than if they were doing it for sustenance in some way, which is a basic biological truism, even in the 24th century, even in the Delta Quadrant.
Yeah. You have raised another interesting question in my head, though, talking about how, oh, well, you know, ideally you'd be a vegetarian, but actually you like meat, and therefore...
Yeah, it's like moral acrasia or weakness. Like, I would like to be a vegetarian, but I'm not going to. I have total moral weakness in this regard.
Yeah, so my question, I think, that's raised from that is, it's like, well, then does that automatically by extension mean that if you want to do something, you can find a way to morally justify it?
Oh yeah, just like Tuvok. No problem. Just call me Tuvok.
Just use logic. It's just logic. It's fine.
I did used to teach logic, so I don't know if I don't know if to the journey listeners know that about me, but I used to teach logic, and you know, I have a degree in philosophy. And that's what I used to do. So yeah, I used to teach logic. I can totally use logic to justify anything. Just call me Mr. Tuvok.
You listeners haven't actually noticed this because when Zachary takes the screenshots for our episodes, when he posts them, he has his headphones on, but he does actually have pointy ears.
Yeah, you guys laugh at me every time I take my headphones off, because literally, you guys, you know, how many hours have we spent doing this? You never see my ears? It's kind of weird. I always have these headphones
on.
We do
look at each other strangely without headphones on. Yes, it is true. But so I think that is interesting because it means that we can easily go, oh, well, the Hirogen are doing something wrong because from our standpoint, we see it as hunting sentient beings and they shouldn't be doing it and it's against our moral code and we wouldn't do it and therefore it's wrong. Whereas actually, for their point of view, it's easy for them to justify it because they want to do it, so they can come up with a reason why it's okay.
And, well, I mean, and if you're at the top of the food chain, you don't have to justify anything, right? Because you're at the top of the food chain. You're the master of your own domain. It's like Nietzsche's Übermensch or something. Like, you know, if you're at the top, then you don't have to give any reasons. And I think that's where the Hirogen are at. They don't need to justify. They don't have to be rational or logical. The Vulcans would analyze it. If a Vulcan had to eat meat all of a sudden to survive, like if Tuvok were stranded on a planet and had to eat meat, right, he would analyze this and he would agonize over the moral dilemma, and he would probably eat the meat because he knows that it's logical to survive, but he would craft this little logical narrative about why it's okay. The Hirogen don't have to do that. They're at the top of the food chain. They're the hunters, so they don't have to justify it to anyone. I think that's their standpoint.
Yeah, but I think they do have a moral code of sorts, because we do see them talking about how they don't let their prey suffer. They're not down with letting the prey suffer, so they've obviously got some kind of moral code about who they're hunting and what they're hunting, even though they show this regard for their right to life.
Isn't that a bit hypocritical, though? Like, they're the savage hunters who view themselves as civilized because they don't let their prey suffer?
Well, it's part of what I was saying about how, well, because they can morally justify it, that's one of the ways that they do it, because they're like, oh, well, we don't let them suffer, so it's okay.
Yeah, but think, I mean, this is where I think I have this basic principle that in Star Trek, the aliens are more like real humans here in the real world. And here in the real world, we use words like nobility, honor, duty, loyalty as a mask for these incredibly horrific things that happen in the world, right? We tend to romanticize it and make those things noble, even the savage things that we do in war and whatnot, right? And I'm not saying that's bad. You have to fight wars. When wars happen, you have to fight wars. But we tend to romanticize it, and we tend to couch the horror of those things in these grandiose, noble terms. And so I could see the Hirogen viewing themselves as very noble, very civilized. They don't let their prey suffer. But really, they're doing these horrific things, just like we do here in the real world when we have to go fight wars.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they go home and they write an epic poem about it, and that makes it okay.
the Hirogen equivalent of Beowulf, right?
They go home and they write an epic poem, and that makes it okay.
I'd like to read some Hirogen poetry.
I think so. I think it'd have a lot of viscera in it, but... Yeah, I think there's kind of a couple of things that I want to consider that we see as differences between these presentations in Deep Space Nine and in Voyager, because I kind of find it interesting that I think they're related as well, actually, because first of all, they don't really tell us this particularly in Deep Space Nine, but I get the impression that they sort of breed these Tosk for the hunt, but I get the sense that actually they only sort of let one out at a time. They've just got one going that they're all after. And maybe it's like an annual thing rather than them doing it all of the time. Whereas obviously with the Hirogen, we know they just go find their own prey and they're constantly doing it.
So, Kay, I feel like you can tell us a lot more about this since you are English and you should know English history more than I do. Isn't there a grand tradition of the great hunt over there, like releasing, you know, an animal into the wild, and then everyone, you know, puts their sport coats on and out they go to go hunting the animal? It's like a ritual, right? It used to be, at least. I don't know if people, do they still do that? I have no idea.
Well, hunting is kind of a hot topic over here because we banned hunting with dogs a few years back now. It's certainly in fox hunting and
like, how long ago was it, like 5 years or 10 years, or 30 years
something like that, maybe, like, more than 5 but less than 10 probably. I don't know exactly. I'd have to check.
I'm thinking like a proper English gentleman kind of hunt, like let the dogs go hunt and you've got your nice clothes on, you're out there on your horseback looking very proper and doing the hunt, right?
Yeah.
That's my American vision of what happens over
there. Yeah, I mean, they still go drag hunting, which is where rather than actually hunting an animal, what they do is somebody gets like a cloth and they drag it through the countryside for however long. And
oh, like a red herring. A red herring.
Yeah.
That's where the phrase red herring comes from, by the way.
They still do that. And they still do hunt foxes and deer with dogs, even though it's illegal. Illegal hunts still do happen. A lot fewer them than used to, but...
Illegal gentleman hunts.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But in terms of what you're talking about, in terms of, like, things being released, they do breed pheasants for shoots, but that's just shooting. That's not, they don't go out and hunt them with dogs. They just go out with guns and shoot them, but they do breed them and release them at a certain time of year.
Yeah. So that's kind of what we're talking about here in Deep Space Nine. They're breeding the space pheasants and sending them out into the wild.
Space pheasants.
Because that's essentially what you're talking about, right? They've bred this, what they view as a lower life form, even though there's part of a subspecies from what we can gather. And they send them out into the wild, and then the gentlemen go hunt these, you know, sentient space pheasants.
Yeah, yeah. I think the thing I was really trying to hit on was whether or not that's... Like, are they doing, like, a whole bunch of them at once, or is it just one?
Oh, I don't think we ever really know, right? But it's clear that that's different from how the Hirogen function, right? That's
yes.
Right. The Hirogen are more... I think you described it before the show as nomadic, right? They're out wandering around. There's no central location from which the hunt begins and where you take your trophy back, right? They're out and about on the hunt in a more nomadic, tribal kind of way.
Yeah, and that's the next extension of that it was related to, which is that we know, obviously, that the Hirogen are nomadic. And that's kind of come about, in a sense, because they're constantly hunting and they don't really... They're constantly out looking for next prey, and their centre of, like, you know, their home world is kind of broken down in that way because they're never there to do anything with it. Whereas, obviously, we find out with the Tosk race that they do have a home world because they're talking about taking him back there. And that's kind of why I was trying to hit on, well, maybe if they're capable of keeping a society running, it is just a thing that they do like once in a while rather than it being a constant process.
I feel like that makes it worse. Like, I understand the Hirogens need to be nomadic and tribal and spiritual and all these, social and cultural factors we've talked about. And, you know, that's how they view themselves. I don't understand, you know, the gentleman's game of hunting. Like, we're the civilized people and we're going to breed something for, you know, just to kill it and send it out in the wild and go kill it and pat ourselves on the back afterwards. I feel like that is morally worse. And it's hard to articulate why, but I find that more repugnant than even the Hirogen, even though the Hirogen are more visceral and violent from what we can tell.
After we've had that discussion, it puts it in my head that I get the sense more with the Deep Space Nine race that actually it is just a game to them.
That's right. It's a game. And for the Hirogen, it's not a game. It's part of their identity. And I feel like in Captive Pursuit, it's largely a souped up gentleman's game. Pheasant hunting.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of ritual and culture and sort of honor around it, but it still feels like it's kind of a thing that they do every now and then that's fun, that's a game, and it's not... you know, such a key part of their identity as it is.
On the other hand, the fact that they want to dress up and play Nazis in the holodeck makes it seem more like a game. So it's hard to really know, right?
That is true. But then I think they're constantly looking for variety, aren't they? They want a new challenge. And obviously when you're constantly hunting all of the time, you're going to get really good at getting around all the potential strategies of your prey, and you need to, you're constantly wanting something that's going to give you more of a challenge.
So I can picture this internal Hirogen monologue of like, I'm so bored hunting space pheasants, I want to go hunt a space turkey because that'll be more challenging.
Yeah,
right. Okay,
a holographic space turkey.
Yes.
Yeah, if that's really changed my view. I don't know, I thought they were largely comparable, but now actually I think you are right. I think in some ways I find the Deep Space Nine scenario a bit worse.
I kind of feel like maybe the Hirogen are kind of the logical consequence of the first version we saw of this in that Deep Space Nine episode. Like, okay, there's this race that likes to hunt another sentient being. What would that really look like? I think it's a little too comical inside Deep Space Nine. So if you say, let's imagine a race where, you know, their culture is intimately wound up with this idea of the hunt, and let's flesh out what that would really look like. And I could see that there's kind of an evolution of thought there. On the other hand, I feel like the Hirogen are more easy to identify with because the second you try to humanize and say, oh, well, they have this whole culture and the whole sociology and all of this, you know, these deep-seated needs and drives to do the hunt, and that's part of who they are. You're like, oh, okay, I understand that now. I don't understand this other thing that's really cheesy back in Deep Space Nine, because that looks more like the pheasant hunt that I really don't understand. You know, so I feel like in the attempt to make them scarier and bring them to their logical conclusion, they actually made them easier to identify with and less scary and less mysterious as a result.
Yeah, because we see how important the hunt is to the Hirogen. I mean, it's everything, you know, to the extent that they allow their entire culture to almost break down because of it.
Well, it's like spending so much money on the hunt that you forget to take care of the castle, right?
Yeah.
That's essentially what's happened there.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And then I think this kind of, because we've now gone on to talking about, you know, the sort of Nazi episode and everything else, and the fact that they obviously realize the fact that they can use the holodeck for this idea, and it causes a sort of development in their culture. I think this circles us back round on the Prime Directive again, doesn't it?
Well, I think without a doubt, in both scenarios, Star Trek is commenting on how repugnant it is generally, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that is a lower stage of evolution versus viewing sentient beings with rights in a more civilized kind of fashion. I think that's the Federation and Star Trek's overall sense of it. But I think you could say that this idea of the hunt is a kind of late medieval Victorian kind of idea. Like, it does represent a certain kind of cultural evolution. It's not barbarism, right? It's not animals out there fighting in the wild, like a lion killing its prey, right? It's more civilized than that. So there is a cultural evolution that's gone along with it. But again, that's commentary on us. We're evolved in some ways, but we still do horrific things. We still eat meat. We still fight wars, and we still have a long way to evolve too. So I think this idea of a civilized society, or the very fact that there is a society, and it's not just barbarism, that there's a society around these things that look visceral and horrific, is commentary on us, because that's who we are. We're very civilized. We solve a lot of problems, but we still fight wars and we still kill each other, and the society still has problems, and we're at a stage of cultural evolution. And Star Trek likes to point the mirror back at its audience and say, look, you're just like these people. You're evolved, but you have a long way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I think because we do see a really big cultural evolution with the Hirogen during the course of Voyager, but obviously that is prompted by the fact that Janeway decides to give them the holodeck technology. So I think because we've already had a really big Prime Directive question with Deep Space Nine, with this whole, well, should O'Brien have helped him? Should Sisko and Odo have helped him? We've got a really big Prime Directive question here. Was it right or wrong for her to do that?
Well, this is a really interesting idea, because we live in the 21st century where we can simulate pretty much anything. So any vice that you have, any moral failing, whatever, you can get your kicks through simulated experiences, right? Video games are a prime example of this. You can probably come up with 20 other examples if you really took the time to think about it. Is that, and I think there's a virtue to that, right? If someone has a problem with violence, giving them a way to express that violence in a totally harmless way with no consequences, it kind of, in a way, it solves the problem, right? The person can still get what they need out of it, and there's no actual harm done to anyone, so everyone's happy at the end of the day. So I think it's a very interesting solution to the problem of moral failings and vices. And I think here in the 21st century, even more so than 20 years ago when these episodes were fairly new, right? We could solve those kinds of problems, or at least chip away at those problems, through simulated virtual reality kinds of experiences in a way that in the whole course of human history, we couldn't do that. You can't say, like, back in the 19th century, Jack the Ripper, right? You couldn't say, what could he do to express his violence other than kill people, right? And here in the 21st century, you could say, well, go play a video game, man, and, you know, pop a Valium. And everything's fine. Here, let me give you a hypospray and an hour on the holodeck. You're good to go. that has become possible now in a way that it wasn't 20 years ago or 100 years ago. So I think it's an interesting commentary on how we might go about solving the problem of moral failings. I don't know what to make of it, but I think that's in the sphere of possibility now more than it was when this first aired, and more than it's been in the history of our species.
Yeah, and I think when you put it that way, it's quite obvious that that's what they're trying to do, that they're trying to say, well, actually, look,
we can solve these problems,
but yeah.
It's like my cat. I have a cat, and she's kind of violent. She likes to attack the other cats. And when I have like this little like stuffed pet bed that I bring into my office here, into my podcast studio, when I put that down in the corner, it pacifies her. She still has her violent tendencies, but she's pacified. She's not going to do any harm now. I feel like this is like a pacifier. Bring back the baby metaphor, given the new baby for Suzanne. This is a pacifier for the Hirogen. Like, here's your pacifier. We know you still want to act out, but here's your pacifier, and you won't actually hurt anyone.
Yeah.
I think it's a perfectly good solution. It certainly violates the Prime Directive, but I think it potentially solves the moral dilemma.
It does. It does. But I still think it's important to have a discussion about whether or not, just because we go, oh, well, look, this solves this problem that we have with the way that they do things, does that automatically make it okay for us to interfere when actually our rules say it's not okay to interfere? And that's the bit that I can't quite get my head around.
Well, and I guess this is, there's two ways you can think of it, right? There, you can think of it from the perspective of trying to minimize the harm that's done. So if your overall view of right and wrong and morality is that your goal was to try to minimize the harm to other people. If giving the Hirogen the holodeck minimizes the number of people that are killed by the Hirogen, then yay, we solved the problem, and that's morally a good thing to do. On the other hand, if you want to emphasize individual rights, you know, the rights of the individual being hunted, it seems to solve that problem too, right? If the Hirogen aren't actually hunting sentient beings, if they're hunting these, you know, any offense to the doctor, sentient hologram aside, if they're hunting mere holograms that are more like shadows that aren't really intelligent, then there's no rights of the hunted to be considered. So it solves that moral problem. Yay. So I think the perspective that it doesn't really respect is this non-interference perspective, right? The idea that you can, that you have the power to shape another culture and the future of an entire race of beings from our own moral standpoint. I think it doesn't solve that. This, you know, I think there's a hubris to that is the main concern. But I think it's interesting that Captain Janeway's approach in giving holographic technology to the Hirogen, it seems to solve the utilitarian concern about harm to other people, and it seems to negate the entire concern of the rights of the hunted because no one's actually being hunted. So I think it's a very clever solution, and at least two of those three perspectives get addressed in that approach.
Yeah, it is a very clever solution. And I know that we see later on it goes slightly askew and goes slightly wrong, but that doesn't necessarily make the original decision and the intent behind it any less valid. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I think Janeway gets a lot of stick for breaking the Prime Directive, which she does on a number of occasions. Although, I have to say, I don't necessarily feel like she breaks the Prime Directive any more than...
Almost as much as Kirk, the other captains. Right?
exactly. And I think she gets more stick for it from what I see than everyone else. But, I mean, I think we have to make allowances for the fact that she's in a very difficult situation and she's got to make all the decisions about when it's right to tweak the rules and when it's not right to tweak the rules, and she's constantly in conflict between the idea of wanting to uphold her Starfleet principles and wanting to do what's best for her crew. She's got these two sets of conflicting responsibilities, and I think that makes life very difficult for her.
She's a couple of bad decisions away from being another Captain Ransom.
She is, and I think, you know, we're digressing a little, but it's an important point to make while we're talking about this, which is the fact that I think the reason that she gets so angry and so irrational when we see the whole Captain Ransom thing is because she sees the fact that she's not that far away from it.
Well, she has to walk this fine line between preserving the safety and the health of her own crew, but trying to uphold some sort of moral standards. And these situations keep coming along that make that really, really difficult. So she has to walk this fine little line and, you know, one step either way and, you know, disaster will strike. Either harm will come to her people or she will become morally repugnant like Captain Ransom. And she has to, you know, stick to that straight and narrow path somehow.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I think that it's unfair in a lot of ways to hold Janeway always to the same standards as we hold Picard and Sisko and Kirk, because they are not so much Archer, because obviously he's pre-Prime Directive and things are different anyway.
You know, Captain Picard has it totally cush and easy on that luxury liner, the Enterprise Absolutely. D anyway, so you can't really compare those captains.
With the entirety of Starfleet headquarters on speed dial.
You know, the folks over at Earl Grey, Trek FM's Next Generation podcast, are rolling their eyes at us like, oh, no, they can't say that about our Captain Picard.
It's fine. It's fine. They say things to try and goad us every week and we never, ever respond. So
we don't take the bait. We're not easy bait, prey so. Like the Hirogen's prey.
No, we're not. We are worthy prey.
We are evolved hunters.
We are.
Well, Kay, it's been so much fun talking about the Hirogen and comparing it to the Deep Space Nine episode, Captive Pursuit. It was an inspired idea for a topic, I have to admit. But this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek.fm.
Previously on Trek.fm, Earl Grey.
The original Enterprise bridge set up with all the panels lit up. They have the sounds of the bridge. I mean, you walk in and there's a sort of reverence that's there, and you can hear the swishing of the doors and the little beeping, and it just seems hallowed ground. And I go walking in every year and just feel the presence of Star Trek.
Meta Trex.
I don't like to have too much time, Zachary, to sit and contemplate, because I do sometimes end up second-guessing my decisions. But that...
Second-guess your whole life if you let yourself.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. That's not good. Absolutely. And honestly, that is a recurring theme, I think, in this season.
Literary Treks.
Oh, Matthew, I'm doing just fine. You know, it's always fun every week to hop on here and talk Star Trek books and comics with you. And I don't know if you realize this, Matthew, but this is our 200th episode of Literary... Wait a minute, Matthew. We don't host this show anymore.
And introducing The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
But if I ended up missing an episode, I would record 45 minutes of blank space on my VHS tape, and then I would wait until it came around, and then I would put the episode in its proper order.
This explains so much.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party podcast apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well.
Well, as always, we would love to hear any thoughts that you have on today's show, and there are lots of different ways you can send them to us. The best place to join in the larger conversation is in the Babel Conference, which is our listeners group on Facebook. If you type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. If you choose message to a Trek FM show and select to the journey, that will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at Trek FM and on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. So Zach, when you're not galloping about the countryside on your horse, blowing your horn, sounding for your prey, where can our listeners find you?
With face paint.
Well, yes, thank with you very face much. Paint.
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy, along with my co-host over there, Mike Morrison. You can find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Voyager with me over there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Kay, how about you? When you're not busy satisfying your vices on the holodeck, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Yeah, that is quite a high percentage of my time, I have to admit. When I'm not there, you can find me in the Babel Conference, and you can always look me up on Twitter. My handle there is ChocoWeeble.
And Kay, we should probably let our listeners know where they can send Suzanne a message and send a welcome to the world message to baby Logan Chakotay Williamson.
Yeah, they can. They can. I don't think that's his middle name, actually.
Just making this up as I go.
So the best place for you to find Suzanne, I think, probably at the moment is on Twitter. Her handle there is KJaneway8. I suspect she probably won't be hanging about in the Babel Conference too much for a while.
And we'll have Suzanne back in a few weeks. It won't be the same without her, but we will keep the To the Journey ship afloat while she is out taking care of business.
We will. And we've got a couple of fun guests hopefully lined up. So yeah, should be good.
Well, if you would like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, one of the best ways you can do that is to become a patron of the network through Patreon. Just visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more, all available through our special patrons website, The Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
Well, as always, we have some people that we would like to thank. Our alpha of the hunt, C. Brian Jones, who is our founder and publisher. Our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp. Aaron Harvey, our art director. Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Shea Matala, our Patreon manager. And we'd love to give a really big shout out to our associate producers, Bruce Lish, Ju Kim, Richard Marquez, Patrick Carlin, and Norman Lau. Thank you so much for your support of To The Journey and of Trek FM.
Also known as our Warpack.
Our Warpack, yes. We've got them out on a bit of a tricky one at the moment. I hope they manage to make it back tonight.
Well, be sure to join us next week when Kay and I will be searching for our inner Tosk. But until then, this has been To The Journey.